Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on AirZilla and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 291 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scene and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose garden, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts and memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers, as well as, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. As much of the country is settling into post-Easter floral extravaganza, we focus this week on some ancillary elements of the world of gardening and the world of plants. We start with a recent article by Ben Cohen, published on April 18th in the Wall Street Journal, inside Home Depot's $20 billion secret garden. The retail giant spends years developing plants and flowers. The goal, make shoppers better gardeners and loyal customers. Dateline, Atlanta. One morning this winter, I woke up and smelled the roses and the petunias. It was a chilly day in early March when I walked into an industrial warehouse behind Suite 900 of an office park, only to find that it was bursting with flowers and the people who breed, grow, and sell them. They are angelonias here, dahlias here, and vincas everywhere. The space had been transformed into a garden center for a spectacle that Home Depot shoppers will never get to see or smell. The event is known inside the company as Spring Trials. This invitation-only showcase is where breeders flaunt their latest offerings and Home Depot's suppliers get their first glimpse of new plants that the retailer spent years helping to develop. Soon they will make their way from greenhouses to Home Depot's and then your garden. The garden business rakes in about $20 billion a year for Home Depot, more than appliances, lumber, or paint. It's one of the biggest departments of the biggest home improvement retailer, covering everything from live goods like plants, flowers, and shrubs to soils, grills, and patio furniture. In fact, it's so big that Home Depot makes more money from its garden divisions than Hermes does from all of its luxury goods. Flowers might not be the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Home Depot, but they have grown to be essential for the company. At the height of the pandemic, Americans splurged on home renovations, driving the company's stock price upward. Since then, higher interest rates and housing prices have lowered demand for expensive projects. Even before the latest economic uncertainty, sales were flat or slightly down in most Home Depot divisions. Gardening is a bright spot. It also helps explain how Home Depot is different from Walmart and Amazon. For those retail giants, holiday shopping is the most important time of the year. At this one, the most lucrative time of the year comes earlier. Home Depot's big holiday is spring, says Dan Stupiello, who's in charge of live goods at the company. And spring at Home Depot really begins at spring trials. One of the fundamental problems for any retailer is figuring out how to turn consumers into repeat customers. For Home Depot, spring trials are part of the solution. So I went to the Plant Expo. Right now, you're in the present, said Jennifer McComish, Home Depot's head of live goods for the Southern Division. But when you walk through those doors, that's the future. Then the doors flung open. When it comes to gardening, those of us who don't know the difference between annuals and perennials have become used to failure. Maybe we buy the wrong plant. Maybe we plant it at the wrong time. Maybe we feed it too much or don't give it enough sun. For any number of reasons, people come away from their experience in the garden believing they just don't have a green thumb. And they don't come back to Home Depot. The only way to build their confidence and brand loyalty is to put all kinds of gardeners in position to succeed. That means making sure we buy the right plant at the right time and nurture it the right way. We have one purpose and one purpose only, McComish said. We work with global breeders and regional growers to make sure we find plants so they have success in their gardens. To find those plants, Home Depot runs 25 trial gardens in 9 climate zones across the U.S., and studies them in the field under a variety of conditions. After all, a plant that thrives in New Mexico might not survive in New Jersey. For security purposes, some of these experimental gardens are hidden in cornfields or through backyard donkey corrals, protected on secret farms before the plants are selected and patented. Every year, the company vets roughly 800 genetic enhancements before 400 make it to the planting stage. As they monitor the trials, Home Depot and its partners focus on key attributes like disease resistance, drought tolerance, and flower power, industry shorthand for color, vibrancy, and bloom size. What they're really trying to do is maximize your odds of a lush garden. They're looking for the seeds of success. At the end of the summer, they select between 40 and 50 plants for production. They come to spring trials to see the results. This is not the way that Home Depot identified the products in more than 2,000 garden centers even a decade ago. In the past, company representatives took buses up and down California to visit individual breeders separately. They would see one plant, then another, and they often wished they could go back and compare this geranium with that geranium. They decided there had to be a more efficient way of making decisions about the plants that Home Depot should carry. So they reinvented the process and brought all those breeders together under one roof. This year, they hosted spring trials near the company's headquarters for the first time. Home Depot's corporate managers still travel around the country for trade shows, scouting roses in Texas and visiting Florida during peak hydrangea season. But they rely on this centralized event to select the plants that millions of Americans will buy for their gardens. The two-day show attracts the biggest names in breeding. They meet with growers and Home Depot representatives to brag about their new plants, new colors, new concepts or flower combinations, even new containers. And almost everything that's new in Home Depot's garden centers this year appeared in spring trials over the past few years. When the doors open into the future, I found myself surrounded by green and shades of pink, yellow, blue, and purple, and lots of Home Depot orange. I joined a group from the Midwest as spring trials began. It was time to get into the weeds. Tomorrow starts today, said Dave Graham, who oversees live goods for the company's Northern Division. Our first stop was the exhibit of a breeder called Danziger, where Graham pulled me over to the Amore petunias. I can't tell a petunia from a pansy, but even I could tell they were striking and that they were named Amore because every bloom had a pattern that looked like a heart. When Home Depot's buyers saw them, they knew they had a Mother's Day hit. Then we made our way over to a collection of houseplants from proven winners, and he pointed out a ficus. This was once upon a time a great plant, he said. That time was long ago. These days, ficuses aren't exactly flying off Home Depot's shelves. The reason that people don't like them is that they drop leaves. If you look at it wrong, a leaf will fall off, Graham said. So how do you breed this plant so it has better foliage retention? And that's where this plant right here comes from, he said. Naturally, it was called a Klingon ficus. There's a similar tale of horticultural innovation in every corner of spring trials. On one side were impatiens and begonias that only grew in the shade, but now thrive in the sun too. On the other side was a basil plant with greater leaf surface to produce a better pesto. And right in the middle of the room was a product that the company's plant nerds were psyched for me to see. "I'm going to show you one that's going to blow your mind," McComish promised. This mind-blowing creation was the latest color of the Super Cal All-Weather Petunia, the rare flower with a heat tolerance that makes it suitable for every U.S. climate. "A unicorn," McComish said. Sometimes breeders follow the lead of Home Depot consumers. For example, hot peppers are huge these days, so there was an entire rack of increasingly hotter peppers at spring trials. Other times, they take directions from Home Depot's specialist. Every year, the company sends a design team to Paris Fashion Week to keep up with the latest color trends. It also tracks gardening behavior across Europe, which tends to be a few years ahead of America. After a brand of dianthus called Pink Kisses popped up in Europe, it came to the U.S. and became a perfect Valentine's Day gift. "There's an advantage in being behind the curve," Stupiello says. There's also an advantage in being a total plant geek. At one point during spring trials, someone walked in and everyone went so completely nuts that I wondered if Taylor Swift had come to buy flowers. It turned out to be another celebrity, a legendary professor of horticulture who wrote the seminal Manual of Woody Landscape Plants. The people who come to spring trials have seen everything, so they gravitate towards stuff they haven't seen. They have to remind themselves of that bias. Breeders love pink roses, but consumers just want their roses to be red. After all, people who shop for plants at Home Depot don't have degrees in horticulture. Graham doesn't either. He started at the company more than 30 years ago as a part-time garden associate to help pay for his business education. He's been with Home Depot in the garden department ever since. His advice for customers is the same thing he tells new hires who know absolutely nothing about plants. "Everything you need to know," he says, "is right here on the tag." Those instructions are crucial because they increase the probability of Home Depot consumers feeling satisfied and returning to the garden center. The company doesn't have an issue finding customers, but it does struggle to retain them. Some get so frustrated that they quit gardening. Others become so obsessed with gardening that they leave Home Depot for local nurseries and garden suppliers, where they're willing to pay more and work with experts who know everything without having to read the tags. As it happens, both want the same thing: healthier plants and prettier flowers that are specifically bred to give them a better chance of success. "At the end of the day," Graham said, "it's all about the success of the customer." And the end of this day at Home Depot could only mean one thing: spring was coming. In our next article, we turn to a different aspect of the retail trade and gardening. It's by Claire Colson. It was published on April 1st in the Financial Times of London. "His Majesty approves. The garden of King Charles III is vividly reimagined." Heritage brand Sanderson's new collection of fabrics and wallpapers tell the story of Highgrove, the king's Gloucestershire garden, bedrock of his nature-first thinking. "It almost feels like archiving the gardens at Highgrove with fabric," says Claire Vallis, design director of heritage brand Sanderson. For the past 15 months, her team has been creating a new collection of fabrics and wallpapers based on the private Gloucestershire garden of King Charles III. "At times, it's been crazy. We've been putting design mood boards together and then sending them to get his approval." The king's final response? He said he couldn't believe what we'd done to represent the garden. When the king bought the handsome Georgian property in the summer of 1980, its garden was an unprepossessing blank canvas. An avenue of stubby golden yews ran west of the house. Trees dotted the parkland, and the original kitchen garden was overgrown and neglected. The one defining feature was a majestic Cedar of Lebanon tree. 45 years later, the garden is a tour de force, fully mature, although never standing still. The original ewes are meticulously clipped into 24 whimsical topiary shapes, swaths of fragrant thyme at their base, while wildflower meadows wrap around the house. There are intimate areas such as the formal sundial garden with its low box hedges and the exuberant cottage garden. Deeper into the estate with more experimental gardens include the atmospheric stumpery, a mass of mosses and magnolias, spring flowering snowdrops and hellebores. This is a garden that is fully grounded in nature, craft, and collaboration, and a magnet for tens of thousands of visitors each year. The new collection, Highgrove by Sanderson, took the King's favorite features and plants, ferns, hostas, and delphiniums among them, as a starting point. But from there, the design team was given free rein to take inspiration directly from the gardens. The fabrics tell their story. The wildflower meadow, for instance, is reimagined with meandering pathways abstracted into cloud-like waves, interspersed with fritillaries and wild blooms. Available as a cotton-linen mix in a brocade woven in Italy, the wildflower meadow design incorporates the King's favorite Acer trees, as well as roaming pheasants, sheep, and deer, and the estate's distinctive carved oak beehive, which were designed by Anthony Payne and commissioned by Fortnum & Mason as a 70th birthday gift in 2018. For head gardener Granny Ring, who first joined Highgrove in 2016 before leaving in 2021 to study and returning last year, the gardens are a marker of the King's commitment to ecological concerns. His Majesty is an environmentalist, and at Highgrove he can contribute to that debate himself, she says. He's been at the forefront of it for a long time. Everyone is doing organic now, but it was very different in the 1980s when he started. All the compost is created on-site except for the bracken used as a mulch on the acid beds, which is brought in from Cumbria and Hampshire. No chemicals are used. The King has a sanguine approach to pests. In an organic setting, you have to accept a certain level of damage as we are working with nature, says Ring. We keep the plants as healthy as possible so that they can recover. But the garden is as prone as any other to common problems, including box blight or box caterpillars, organic sprays, pheromone traps, and using disease-resistant varieties have so far helped avoid any catastrophic damage. The biodiverse grassland of the meadow now has 70 plant species and 7 native orchids, including the green-winged orchid. It's a threatened species, but we have it here, says Ring. It's amazing to think about how it's been built up and how the King has followed through on what he's talked about. He's done it himself. At the same time, when the then Prince of Wales first arrived at Highgrove, a 31-year-old gardening novice, he was helped by a string of mentors and collaborators, including garden designers Molly Salisbury and Rosemary Veery, naturalist Dame Miriam Rothschild, and art historian Sir Roy Strong. And collaboration continues. The garden team creates briefs for new planting, but the King will make the final selection, adding long-held favorites such as the Generous Gardener or Lady Waterlow Roses. They've recently boosted the stumpery with new tree ferns, added a new rose garden, and renovated the Thyme Walk, which was originally planted in the 1990s by the King. Highgrove is a highly personal garden, decorated with objects that have been collected on travels or gifted by family, friends, or organizations. Its eclecticism is keenly felt in the Sanderson collection, too. The intricately carved gate that greets visitors was originally found in Hodpur and is named after Queen Camilla's late brother, Mark Shand. It has provided the starting point for a richly embroidered fabric called Shand Gate, made with a newly developed technique at an Indian mill. Embroidery is coated with ink and then blown off the surface, leaving puddles of dye that evoke the door's tactile carvings. There are further references to hand-woven West African Ue Kente cloth, to Ikat fabrics, and to embroidered Suzanis from Uzbekistan. You see a lot of Suzanis in British country homes, and the King collects them, says Vallis. The Sanderson take features stylized floral motifs with dense embroideries, and is named after the Queen's sister, Annabel Elliot, an interior designer and frequent collaborator on the King's properties. British decorating has always been very layered, and that eclecticism was something we were keen to explore because the garden has lots of influences from around the world, adds Vallis. The ultimate endorsement comes from the royal household. They are using the collection, so that's fantastic, says Vallis, who has already been working on special versions with unique scales or color palettes. Each new design also pulls inspiration from drawings and textile fragments in Sanderson's vast archive at Voysey House in Chiswick, London, which contains more than 70,000 documents. An early 20th century chintz, for instance, has been reworked to incorporate the king's much-loved delphiniums. He is patron of the Delphinium Society, and the towering blue flowers are a significant feature of Highgrove Gardens. A toile de jouy, something the Sanderson team was keen to include for its classicism, but also its storytelling potential, began with an 18th century print. The original design has been redrawn to incorporate Highgrove's swagged yew hedging, topiary, and terracotta pots. The hedge that encloses the sundial garden close to the house is also included, a bust of the king nestled within. The toile was produced at the historic fabric printer Standfast and Barracks, established in 1924 in Lancaster. Moreover, this is a collection that showcases heritage craft in every piece of cloth or paper. Each artist working on a design is handpicked for a particular skill, says Vallis. We either draw in-house, or we go to a specific artist that we know has maybe a more botanical hand, or someone that's more painterly. An archive Walter Crane design from 1902 has been repainted to incorporate the fruits and blossom of the tunnel of espalier apple trees in the kitchen garden at Highgrove. The wallpaper is surface printed in Sanderson's factory on machines that are 100 years old. There's not many of them left in the country now, and it requires real skill to keep these machines going, says Vallis. There have been stories in the press about how expensive wallpapers are, but it's a craft. We've got several generations working in our factories. As a country, we need to value it more. If we don't, we will lose it. The king is on board. 10% of net sales from the collection will go to the King's Foundation. The charity supports myriad crafts with courses and workshops across the country and beyond on subjects ranging from farming and rural skills to fine furniture making. At the entrance to Highgrove, a cluster of buildings has been transformed into studios and workshops for some of the Foundation's students. The gardens also have a role to play in this work. Since opening to tours in 1996, they have raised millions for the King's charities. At Highgrove, there are always new projects, says Ring, who has been overseeing the planting of imposing topiary beds made with specimens gifted to the King for his 70th birthday. A new topiary tour promises to be a highlight for visitors this season. And, of course, there's a fabric to go with that, too. Topiary View, a hemp-based cloth, is a whimsical take on the vista from the west side of the house so that we can all gaze on the king's own views over his topiary lawns this summer. We turn next to a recent column published on April 4th in the Financial Times from our good friend Robin Lane Fox. At last, a leader who isn't tariff-obsessed. Jahangir, the Mughal poet, was a seizer of worlds, hunter of lions, and heavy drinker. But he was also a lover of plants and hater of customs duty. Are there heads of state who have an understanding of flowers, plants, and gardens? Their decisions do irreversible damage to nature, so it might help if they had ever worked with it. Macron with a spade? Modi sowing marigolds? Last year, I admired planting around the Trump Hotel and Golf Course at Doonbeg in Ireland. I do not think there was any Donald in the detail. The exception of the moment is currently on show in London, Jahangir. He ruled in India from 1605 to 1627, the fourth in a dynasty of rulers whom outsiders called Mughals, though they came from what is now Uzbekistan and saw themselves as Timurids, descendants of Tamerlane the Great. Jahangir took his name because it meant World Caesar, that's S-E-I-Z-E-R, not the Roman Emperor. Despite this ominously modern ring, he never lived up to it. He had different talents, some of which are on display in the Victoria and Albert Museum's excellent exhibition, The Great Mughals, which runs until May 5th. Like no modern ruler, he links up with flowers and gardens in intriguing ways. One link is the array of flowers and plants in the miniature paintings, textiles, and carpets that he patronized. Examples of them are at the heart of the V&A show, including a magnificent carpet pattern with double red poppies. Artists at the Mughal court rendered flowers with such exquisite care that many can be recognized as relations of those outdoors in our spring garden. However, the captions accompanying the exhibit suffer from a besetting affliction of curated information, floral myopia. They refer to floral patterns or borders, but they never identify the flowers depicted in such careful detail. Keen gardeners have plenty to examine and add when they visit. Yehung here patronized major painters, calling one of them the wonder of the age and another the wonder of the epoch. Mansur and Abul Hasan deserve these names of honor. Sometimes they painted from living models, but as the curators explain, Mughal artists also used pattern books by European engravers. The V&A aptly shows pages by the Flemish Collaert family that presents aquilegias and dianthus, copied by artists in Jahangir's reign. His artists' attempt at rendering a cyclamen are so wayward that they too must be based on printed sources. The best accompaniment to the show is elsewhere, a text by Jahangir himself. Like two of his predecessors, he wrote memoirs in Persian, known as the Jahangirnama. They are best translated by the Harvard professor Wheeler Thaxton in a book beautifully produced by the Freer Gallery in Washington and published in 1999. In it, Jahangir describes his travels, his principles, and his personal failings. He also dwells on trees, flowers, birds, and animals that impressed his observant eye. He was a frequent lover of the beauty of Kashmir. He even listed the plants that he found so lovely there and remarked how meadows held hundreds of them, which Mansur then drew, evidently from life. He makes me pine to revisit that contested region. World Caesar, he may have called himself, but he issued a command, seldom discussed, that is particularly timely. In the Sharara Garden in Kabul, he decreed that customs duties and tariffs were to be abolished, and that any successor who reinstated them would be struck by divine wrath. These imposts were considered contrary to Islamic law. He inscribed his decree on a big slab of stone and set it up between his two favorite plane trees in the garden. No such plaque exists at the Mar-a-Lago golf course. Jahangir also hunted, drank, and knew how to write poetry. Between the age of 12 and 50, he calculated, he had killed 28,532 wild animals, including 10 crocodiles and more than 80 lions. He declared 2 days a week, in a month or so in each year, to be a no-meat period. But he never contemplated a total hunting ban. He also recorded his increasing consumption of wine, then spirits, from the age of 18, leading him on to opium twice a day in middle age. His 12 principles for his subjects include a ban on wine and intoxicants. If there had been a Timurid lockdown, there would surely have been exceptions in his favorite parties in his gardens in Kashmir. In her admired 2023 book, Courting India, Nandini Das describes England's envoy, Thomas Rowe, in his prolonged visit to Jahangir's court. Jahangir never even mentions Rowe in his memoirs. Das misses an important trick while evoking audiences with the ruler. She passes over the personal memoir of Murtibi from Samarkand, a 70-year-old visitor from the dynasty's homeland who came while Rowe was hanging around the court. He's a witness not only to Jahangir's interest in Central Asia, his family's homeland, but to the importance of poetry in bids for his favor. Murtibi greeted Jahangir with elegant verses, whereupon Jahangir replied in verses composed on the spur of the moment. Wine and opium had not dimmed his gift for verse, a hallmark of his court and ancestry. Rowe from England knew next to no Persian and could never have competed. Kashmir, Jahangir wrote, is a perennial garden. He described the harvest of saffron crocus there. still a major crop, as I witnessed in 1978, the flowers were so scented that it gave him and his followers a headache. He also names impressive trees, though I doubt the translation of one as a yellow-flowered Judas tree, as the flowers of a Acersus are pink or white. Roses, violets, and narcissi, he states, grow wild in the meadows, followed by blue jasmine. Like his predecessors, he laid out gardens around the Dal Lake, one of the most enchanted landscapes in the world. He had an impassioned eye for fruits, too. He marveled at the cherries of Kashmir, finer, he judged, than those round Kabul, which hung like red butterflies in the trees. He ordered them to be propagated and spread through his gardens. He was not a trained botanist, let alone an ecologist before his time. He was impressed by beauty and the unusual, whether bicolored flowers, hollow trees, or in a garden, or a gardener's daughter who had a mustache, a beard, and a flat, hairy chest. Recorded, he wrote, because it was so strange. In Kashmir, in March 1620, he encountered another curiosity, a strange flower with an odd shape, whose flowers were orange with heads hanging down and leaves around them like a pineapple. Plainly, it was a crown imperial, one of those orange or yellow fritillaries that flower intermittently in British gardens in spring. He also admired how the walls, courtyards, gateways, and roofs of houses came alive with tulips, black ones even on a mosque's roof. Here, too, I read him with a pang. In October, I planted hundreds of tulips for this year's spring. In Oxford, some have been uprooted and chewed by gray squirrels. For Jahangir, a superb painting by Abul Hassan shows adorable little squirrels nesting in a tree, brown ones, however, not rat-like grays. At home, I planted tulips in pots, but in one night, an uninvited Munjak deer ate the lot, as if they were eye-level takeaway. Indiscriminate wildlife in the garden? I want Jahangir back, a hunter of deer as well as of lions. He is the head of state who would keep my tulips safe. The great Mughals, art, architecture, and opulence is at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London until May 5th. vam.ac.uk is the website. We close this week with a pan to southern live oaks in South Carolina, an opinion piece written by M.L. Kavanaugh and published in the Los Angeles Times on April 20th. Inspiration from the species that can live 1,000 years and put down a new set of roots anytime. For a Yankee in the South, everything about the environment scares you off. Heat, humidity, flying termite season. Seriously, it's a thing. But this cold and snow-loving northerner braved the bugs recently, in part to get away physically and mentally from a divorce. As amicable and respectful as our divorce was, it still felt like a sort of spiritual death, the end of a life, if not my own life. So I ate, prayed, and loved my way down to visit good friends in the Gulf Coast town of Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. I left with a crush on a special tree. And this week that includes Easter Sunday, Earth Day, and Arbor Day seems like a grand time to share why your heart might flutter a little for the southern live oak too. As I walked to a coffee shop a few blocks from my friend's place, I saw it next to a speed limit sign, a tree branch doing something I'd never seen before. To the right, I could see a great oak's school bus long branch dip downward, where it had not just touched the ground, but had kept growing and buried itself into the soil. Upon closer inspection, I saw that a whole new trunk had emerged from this same buried woody mass. The sagging branch had given rise to a new tree. I did what we do nowadays and searched and searched and searched the web to understand what I'd seen. The trees were southern live oak. It appears what I saw was a natural form of layering, whereby a branch touches the ground and produces adventitious roots driven by hypoxia and the hunt for resources. That sagging branch never fully dies when it hits the ground, but at some point it can cease to be part of its original tree. With new roots, seeks a newer, fuller life, which it finds as a second tree. Zoom out from that amazing branch to the southern live oak, Quercus virginiana, and you can see life itself. Native to the southeastern United States, they're known for their longevity, living beyond 1,000 years. A keystone species, southern live oaks host and support many other diverse species, including Spanish mosses and little ferns. They sponsor a whole ecosystem and their wide wooden arms. They're so sturdy that settlers used to lash themselves to southern live oaks as storm trees to ride out hurricanes. And the world's oldest ship still afloat, the USS Constitution, nicknamed Old Ironsides, commissioned in 1794 by President George Washington, features a frame made of southern live oak. But it's less these characteristics than the character of the tree that stands out. Its shape, especially. It's almost horizontal. It reaches for you, which isn't what you're conditioned to expect from a big tree. Redwoods and the like are skyscrapers, straight and aloof, while southern live oaks spread their branches all around you. It's as close to a hug from a tree as you can get. Tree huggers, take note. This is your preferred partner if you're looking for some leafy action. Of the 3 trillion trees on Earth, 2 southern live oaks in particular stand out to me. The McDonough Oak in New Orleans' City Park is more than 800 years old, long enough to reach back to the Magna Carta and Crusades. Hurricane Katrina felled more than 2,000 trees in City Park, but not McDonough, though the grandfatherly tree now requires crutches to keep its massive limbs aloft. Head east an hour or so, and you'll find the ever more striking Friendship Oak on the Gulf campus of the University of Southern Mississippi. It's old too, at 538 years, so it breathed the same air as Christopher Columbus and the 18 generations of people who lived from its birth until now. The Friendship Oak spreads out with 10 tentacles dipping into and up from the grass like a friendly, green, and grounded Loch Ness monster. Sometimes we get sidetracked a little with the bunnies and baskets around this time of year, but we can get beyond those a bit to see the beauty and bounty in our everyday biological world. Easter, Earth Day, and Arbor Day, all happening in the same week this year, this Sunday, Tuesday, and Friday, share a common emphasis on renewal, both spiritual and environmental. And somewhere in the middle of this milieu is the southern live oak's process of layering. Heck, even its name includes the word live. That might seem redundant when naming a plant, but these things earn the distinction. It's good now and then to look out and see that our trees are remarkable, not just resources or obstacles or ornaments. They are life itself, a part of our lives, and we are part of theirs. They should give us hope. Getting home to Colorado, I was greeted by vistas of pine and scrub oak, in time to see the buds opening at the ends of so many twigs. Sure, our local trees aren't as knockdown impressive as the southern live oak, but their potential and promise is the same. Each pine cone, an acorn, has a chance to grow its own way into another mighty tree, a thought that gave me a flash of hope. Easter eggs are everywhere if you know where to look. M. L. Kavanaugh is the author of the forthcoming book, Best Scar Wins, How You Can Be More Than You Were Before. That wraps up edition 291 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.lars.org, L-A-R-R-S, or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house or urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Till the next time.